Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, an economist discusses the worst decline in the U.S. economy since the end of World War II. But up front, 25 million Americans live in the area known as Appalachia. The region includes portions of 13 states, including most of Pennsylvania. Appalachia still lags behind the rest of the nation in many areas of economic development. Pennsylvania, for example, has lost more than 500,000 jobs since February 2020. The reimagined Appalachia Coalition has developed an infrastructure blueprint they say will create 250,000 jobs in Pennsylvania. Joining us, Stephen Herzenberg, Executive Director of the Keystone Research Center, and Jackie Bonomo, President and CEO of Penn Future, and also a founding and executive committee member of Reimagine Appalachia campaign. Jackie Bonomo, let me start with you. What is Reimagine Appalachia?
Good morning, Scott. Reimagine Appalachia is a multi-state coalition, as you said, campaign and blueprint that was pulled together to really seed and grow a 21st century economy for the region. So really, for far too long, this region has given to the country literally been extracted from for our timber resources, for our fossil fuels, including coal, including gas, including oil. And we really feel that the time has come for that economic base to diversify and for other sectors to really be grown and level the playing field for the fossil fuel economy that has really dominated the region for such a long time. So the coalition came together to really develop and put forth that alternative economic development and job creation vision. And we're really excited to talk a little bit about that and the jobs report that we released this week for ways that we see Pennsylvania jobs could grow based on the ideas in our platform.
We're going to talk about some of the specifics of your plan, but what are the goals overall?
The goals are first and foremost to create a 21st century economy for Appalachia, to create good, strong wage paying and benefit providing jobs, to strengthen our unions, to really lift communities, frontline communities, including communities of color in Appalachia that for far too long have been at the core of, again, providing incredible services, energy in particular to the country, but have been forgotten. And this is an opportunity for that to shift.
Steve Herzenberg, go ahead.
Do you mind if I jump in here?
Yeah, go ahead.
Is that okay, Scott?
Yeah. I was going to ask a question anyway, Steve, but go ahead.
All right. So, no, I think you have to put this campaign kind of in the context of two things, really. You know, one is that action on climate change is coming. I mean, we talk about, is it coming? It's coming in 1 year or it's coming in 5 years, but it's coming, and it's coming because the imperative to reduce carbon emissions and to try to mitigate the already widespread damage that's evident from climate change is the political system is going to respond to that. It frankly looks now like there's going to be major federal action on climate this year. But the second part of the context for this campaign is, and Jackie alluded to this, but is really this particular region. This region includes parts of West Virginia and Kentucky that have had persistent poverty for decades. This region also includes parts of southeastern Ohio and southwestern Pennsylvania that were actually had a very strong middle class, did very well in the New Deal decades, but for the last 40 years have suffered through downward mobility. And so if you're going to address climate change in this region, you have to do it in a way that is deeply aware of the economic anxiety and struggles of this region. And from our perspective, some of the national debate around, you know, Green New Deal hasn't been anchored adequately in terms of the traumatic economic experience of working people in our region. And so we've approached this, and our framework, you know, makes it clear in many different places, but we've approached this as you must show why aggressive action on climate is actually a potential big winner for economic opportunity, because our region has hungered for another win on economic opportunity for four decades. The reality is you can make that case now because we're at a point where you have to make such substantial investments in sustainable transportation, in renewable energy and smart grid, in planting trees and using our natural infrastructure to absorb more carbon, in clean manufacturing. You know, you go down the list of the places where we have to invest at scale, and it turns out that you're going to have a lot of trades and industrial type jobs created by that investment. So the fact is, if we do this right, if we, for example, have wage standards and ensure that workers have the right to organize on the construction of permanent jobs created but from this public investment and private investment, then this will be the rebirth of opportunity in the Ohio Valley, in this central part of Appalachia. And at the same time, it'll be what we all absolutely must have, which is a big reductions in carbon emissions.
You both have touched on this, but Jackie, let me ask you about it specifically. When I think of Appalachia, and I'm sure that when many people think of Appalachia, they think of coal. And part of your plan, Steve talked a little bit about this, is you're looking at cleaning up the remnants of coal mining and maybe some other things that the resources that were taken from the land. But employ those who have worked in the coal industry. What are your plans for that?
So a lot of the jobs that we envision happening are doable with skill sets that are already in place in the region. So you mentioned the incredible legacy of coal mining, both in terms of 250,000 acres of abandoned mine lands still remaining here in Pennsylvania that really are useless until they get addressed, until they get restored, and similar numbers when it comes to water quality. We've got hundreds of thousands of abandoned and leaking orphaned oil and gas wells that need to be addressed, and both the water impacts, the land impacts, and the air impacts of that legacy pollution can be addressed by individuals that are currently working in things like the construction trades right now. With coal workers, we have to be incredibly sensitive to the fact that that industry is essentially in its demise. We've lost 50% of coal generation here in Pennsylvania over the course of the last 4 years. So the decline is imminently upon us. We see opportunities to influence and shape federal legislation and federal investments that we anticipate coming from the Biden administration. Steve mentioned the infrastructure work. We've got CARES money that from CARES 1 and CARES 2 that still has yet to be allocated and distributed, and we certainly have are waiting for CARES 3 to be completed. But our campaign intends to shape both that legislation and the way that money is expended so that we're thinking first and foremost about impacts on those workers, and making sure wherever possible that those investments are prioritized for communities that are going to be impacted by coal becoming less of an influence in those local economies.
Steve, let me follow up on that, and I don't want to get too far in the weeds, but talking specifically about those who have worked in the coal industry, there have been federal programs for, and probably state programs as well, for the last few years that have tried to retrain those working in the coal mines, in the coal industry, for other jobs. Now, maybe the momentum for that, those retraining efforts slowed down during the Trump administration when they were told that coal was going to make a comeback. But still, there have not been a lot of people who worked in the coal industry that have embraced job retraining and getting reeducated. What would have to happen? What would, under this plan, under this blueprint, that would make them want to do that?
Sure. I mean, the problem with past efforts, I mean, for coal workers, frankly, the problem more broadly with a lot of U.S. training programs is the line sometimes is train and pray. So that when the training's done, there's not a clear understanding that there's going to be a job that uses that skill at the end of the training. And if there is a job, there's nothing to guarantee it's going to be a good job. And so what's different about this plan is we're not talking about train and pray. We're talking very explicitly about helping dislocated coal workers use the skills they already have. I mean, there are a lot of electricians, for example, in the coal industry that can be redeployed in other industries, including the clean energy industries. But if necessary, top up their skills. But then with the investment, with the protection of workers' union rights, then they have a shot at getting another unionized job that pays equivalent to what they had before. So that's really, and some of the ability to do that is when it comes to repairing the damage, West Virginia, parts of southwestern Pennsylvania, actually parts of northeastern Pennsylvania where Jackie is, because there was more extraction in the past, there is more damage. So when Bob Casey, Senator Bob Casey and Senator Joe Manchin, both of whom thankfully are very powerful in the US Senate on these issues, when they're working this climate infrastructure plan through the US Senate for President Biden's signature, they're going to be making sure that our region gets its share. So a lot of that reclamation work, I mean, the work is where the displaced workers are. So those jobs need to be good jobs, and we can place people in those jobs. It's also true that in terms of the investment in clean energy, investment in clean manufacturing, there has to be sensitivity to where people are losing jobs. I mean, the good news is we're talking about creating well over 10 times as many jobs through this plan as will be lost in the first few years. And, you know, beyond that, the numbers are going to get even better. So we need to get on, as a planet, as a state, we need to, you know, get on the aggressive path to zero carbon emissions by the middle of this century. And again, we can do it in a way that it's a team effort in which workers are not forced to put up with the kind of stagnation, wage and income stagnation and decline that they have in the last 40 years. This really can be a renewal of our state and our country, as well as the environmental policies we have to have.
We're going to talk more about that in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program, we're talking about the Reimagine Appalachia Coalition and their blueprint for bringing back jobs and industry in the Appalachia region of the country that includes 13 states. Pennsylvania is part of that. Stephen Herzenberg is executive director of the Keystone Research Center. Jackie Bonomo, president and CEO of Penn Future, and also a founding and executive committee member of the Reimagine Appalachia campaign. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Just want to tick off some of the highlights of the blueprint. Repair damage done in the last century, talking about the landscape, the land in Appalachia. Modernize the electric grid. Expand manufacturing by making it more efficient and clean. Build a sustainable transportation system. And relaunch the Civilian Conservation Corps. Want to talk about talk about as many of those things as we can. But Steve Herzenberg, I want to get back to what you were just talking about before the break. You're describing this as an effort to create good paying jobs, and you mentioned union, that they would be union jobs. How can you, I don't want to use the word guarantee, but how can you make that happen? I mean, politically, a lot of Appalachia is conservative. I would dare say probably in the last election voted for Donald Trump. So, you know, how can you make it so that these jobs are good paying jobs and, as you said, union jobs?
You can't guarantee that. What you can do through public policy, which hasn't been done in the last 40 years, is you can protect people's right to organize. And if we do that, many of these jobs in the trades, but other sectors as well, will be unionized. I mean, our region may be conservative now, but this region really was the birth of the labor movement. I mean, the United Mine Workers were inspired the creation of the industrial union movement that emerged in the 1930s, the Congress of Industrial Organizations. So the working people of this region in their bones sort of understand exploitation, understand company stores, and understand the violent repression of workers organizing. And have a tradition of fighting back against that and demanding that the respect that they deserve. And we're counting on the good working people of this region to, again, lead the effort to strengthen unions in this country and create what we call a new deal that works for us. I mean, we've been really... the labor movement, which we've been talking to throughout the development of our plan, and when we did our release of the study week before last, showing that the Reimagine framework would create nearly 250,000 jobs in Pennsylvania. We had the president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Rick Bloomingdale, on that call. There's a video of that press conference on the Reimagine Facebook Live page. We also had the Harrisburg area, the capital region leader for the electricians, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, is a guy called Rob Baer. And he's a real champion for aggressive climate response and for the jobs potential. And for him, it's not theoretical. I mean, the last couple of years, he's had utility scale solar projects that are employing hundreds of his members for a full year. So he knows that the action we need to save the planet is going to be a real boon for his union and for his members, and more unions across our region and with the leadership of our region across the country, I think, are getting this memo. And So I think, you know, it's not going to happen automatically, but if with the right campaign to get the right policies, and then you know, with workers getting from policymakers through the bully pulpit as well as through policy, getting the support they haven't had for four decades around, they have a right to come together to demand decent wages in the economy of the future, just like they demanded them and got them in the economy of the past. That's how this is going to happen.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think at the end of the day, the best guarantee that you could have is to have union at the table during the conversations. And I think that that's one thing that really distinguishes Reimagine Appalachia, is that we do have labor and union, not only in mind, but part of the conversations. Union leaders certainly understand that there are immense opportunities around clean energy installations at scale, energy efficiency projects at local small business levels, and that these jobs could all be done by their workers. And so, you know, we're very, very keen to continue to forge common ground with the labor folks that have been with us up until now, and more importantly, encourage those that have not yet been part of the conversation to please think about getting involved with us, because we feel this is an incredible opportunity for not only the region, but for Pennsylvania specifically.
Here's an email from a listener, and I want to follow up on just what we were talking about, too, after this email. But Megan asked, increasing jobs is a great goal for the Appalachia area, but why are we not addressing issues such as lack of access to education, transportation, health care, and basic food resources? Meeting this population's basic needs from childhood up to adulthood seems to be falling short for decades, almost as a forgotten people of America. Now, granted, you could ask, it would be almost like a chicken or the egg thing. If a person has a job, maybe these other things will follow. But Jackie, what about that? I mean, this traditionally, I mean, I always think back to when John Kennedy was running for president and the nation was surprised at the amount of poverty in Appalachia. And it really has not improved a whole lot since then. So Megan's point about addressing the basics, maybe before even jobs. What do you say to that?
No, I mean, Megan is absolutely right. And I think if you dig into the Reimagine Appalachia platform, you'll see that we are exactly there. So let's just talk about what constitutes the basics these days. The bottom line is that it's very hard for communities, for individuals, for families to function without access to, for example, broadband. So our rural areas are really being left out. That's why infrastructure is a core piece of the Reimagine Appalachia platform. So by improving rural broadband, you get the improvements in access to good education that you need. And even in terms of agricultural improvements, both from small farmers to big ag producers, you know, you really can't do business these days, and you can't operate an ag operation efficiently without having access to technology and without having access to, and that means broadband. And so I think in a very direct way, the platform and the campaign acknowledges Megan's concerns and attempts to address it through major investments that that have got to be made in infrastructure, and again that has to come about as a result of major federal investments that need to be made in this region and for Appalachia to get its fair share of those investments.
Sarah asked, and she asked about the new presidential administration. I think that you both touched on it, that you feel that the Biden administration will provide more support here. But Sarah asked, what types of efforts will be made to conserve the unique Appalachian culture while changing the economic tune? Who wants to take that one?
First of all, in terms of the Biden administration, I can't resist. President Biden came out with an executive order last week on climate which had the phrase good union jobs 11 times in it. And we interpret that as two things. One is it's one of the indications that the new administration is very much on the same page we are in terms of there being a potential jobs and climate winner from aggressive climate response. But the other interpretation is we think that's got something to do with the Biden administration actually finding our campaign and our messaging as being, you know, powerful and sort of embracing some of it. And now I've managed to get my, remind me again, Scott, what the listener asked.
Talk about the culture, preserving the culture of Appalachia.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect. So again, we've been very careful. I mean, we started this campaign again with this basic notion that the national climate change debate had been tone deaf to the challenges of our region, you know, including because of the struggles of working people, and in particular because of a region which is losing some of the carbon jobs. How can you make aggressive climate response a winner for that region? So from the beginning, we've been, you know, we invited some national groups, for example, to a founding digital convening in March of last year, which was a conversation that led to our framework. But we were pretty careful to not let too many of the national groups in, to not let them dominate the conversation. And we've really been trying to, there's been lots of good work in our four-state region over decades, trying to figure out how to, for example, support local wealth creation. That's a movement within the region. There's been lots of work in terms of reclamation of abandoned mine lands. There's been local efforts. One of the things that sparked Reimagine Appalachia were local efforts in like Beaver County, Pennsylvania, to the northwest of Pittsburgh, Reimagine Beaver County, and similar efforts in five other communities in Pennsylvania and West Virginia over the last few years. We created one of the poor research analysts at Keystone Research Center had to put together a giant annotated bibliography summarizing all the key reports that had been done sort of moving in the direction of our overall framework. So we built this framework in partnership with lots of people who've been in the trenches in this region for decades. And so this framework is, you know, is Appalachian built, and we're going to do advocacy over the next few months to get the kind of federal package we need. So yeah. So the bottom line is that respect for the culture of this region is deeply in the DNA of this campaign.
We only have a few minutes left, but Morgan asked, talking about saving the planet and thousands of Americans out of job due to President Biden's executive order. I think Morgan is referring to the president canceling the Keystone XL pipeline. Which is more important to consider at this time, saving the planet, climate change, or providing jobs? And let me just add to that, people. I mean, I think I can anticipate your answer, but what about that? I mean, is there a priority here? I am hearing a lot of talk of union jobs. I'm hearing a lot of talk about the climate. But what about the people? Is there a priority here?
Well, so let me answer quickly and then kick it to Jackie. We think that the idea that we have to choose between the environment and the economy, that's a false dichotomy. And in fact, it's politically, it misses the critical point politically. In the end, addressing climate change, it's like fighting World War II. You can't do it without everyone on board, without everybody united, recognizing that you have to beat fascism, or in this case, you have to save the planet because there is no planet B. And you can't have that team effort if too many working people feel they're getting the short end of the stick, and if they're worried about Megan's question earlier, if they're worried about putting food on the table or paying rent, then that's their preoccupation, and that's going to mean we don't have the social cohesion, the team effort we need. So the bottom line is we have to, and we can do this in a way that restores broad prosperity, restores more social unity in this country. And from that foundation, everyone will be thrilled because to do their part to save the planet. Frankly, lots of working people, again, a lot of the jobs we're talking about are jobs that don't require a four-year college degree. We call actually the trades workers, sometimes the essential workers of climate response. So we're going to be talking about giving those people who've been denied decent wages and respect and dignity for decades, we're counting on them and their skills and their effort to help us beat back climate change. So again, there is no tension here if you approach climate change from an understanding of the need to respect working people and have shared prosperity. That's how we get a victory on climate change.
Jackie, one final question. Where do you go with this blueprint?
Full speed ahead. So one of the things that's really exciting about the jobs report, the jobs creation report that was published this week by Reimagine Appalachia, is that it amplifies the same kind of ideas and substantiation that is coming from other parts of the region. So I'm thinking about the Marshall Plan for Middle America that has been published by 8 Appalachian region mayors, including Mayor Peduto out of Pittsburgh, that's talking about the same thing. And so we're seeing really a critical mass, a clamoring of these ideas and platforms. You know, the bottom line is we have work to do. We're facing multiple emergencies, from racial divides, the pandemic, economic recession, and the climate emergency. They're all interconnected. I think that the research in this report proves that this is no longer about jobs versus the environment. We've got to make the investments in the short term to get people back to work. And for the long term, we've got to set this region up for a 21st century economy that's greener and more sustainable, and that really builds off of all the good things that this region has to offer, from its incredible landscape to the grit and work ethic of the people that live here. So full speed ahead. I really encourage people to take a look at Reimagine Appalachia's webpage and our Facebook page if you have time. And that's where we are, and that's where we're going.
Steve Herzenberg is Executive Director of the Keystone Research Center, and Jackie Bonomo is President and CEO of Penn Future, also a founding member and executive committee member of Reimagine Appalachia campaign. Thank both of you for being with us today. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on Monday's Smart Talk, there is a lot going on right now with the pandemic and many of the other issues that we are facing right now, the rollout of the vaccine. And you have to ask yourself, when we're talking about state government, is it working right now? There's a great divide between the Republicans and Democrats. Often doesn't seem like they're even on the same page when it comes to some issues. On Monday's show, we're going to be talking with a couple of veteran observers about whether state government is actually working right now. That's coming up on Monday's Smart Talk. The coronavirus pandemic continues as the greatest threat to the global economy. A recent report showed that the U.S. economy contracted 3.5% last year. That's the largest decline since 1946, just after World War II. It's the first decline since 2009, the Great Recession. And just today, a new jobs report was out that the country added 49,000 jobs. I guess on one hand, that's good news, but on the other hand, that's not a robust addition of jobs in this country. Joining us now is Dr. Maria Ivanova Reyes, assistant professor and economist at Gettysburg College. Dr. Reyes, welcome to the program. Contracting at 3.5%, what does that mean to the average American?
Good morning. Thanks for having me this morning. So this contraction in economic terms is unprecedented. The global financial crisis, the episode in which we saw a never heard recession similar to that since the Great Depression in 2008-2009, was an anomaly that economists were not expecting. And what we are seeing now is something even beyond that. The recession is very different because of being triggered by a global pandemic. It represented a very sharp activity. And for the average American, I will say that the effects are very dissimilar across Americans. There are some people who have been negatively affected in a moderate way, and those are groups in higher income levels. But those in lower income brackets and those who depend on the service economy have been severely affected for a long period of time and will continue being affected until we control the trigger of the pandemic, which is the health safety issue that prevents many businesses to operate in normal ways.
So you hit on it exactly what I was going to ask next, and that is that the service sector of the economy has been the hardest hit during this pandemic and the economic recession that followed it. And that those making, and I don't even know what that level of income is, but those, I mean, you don't have to be rich. Those who are not working in the service sector, who have kept their jobs, they've done well, but they've been able to keep from, you know, going to food banks for the most part, being able to provide the essentials. So how do we provide for those people, or what do we do to strengthen this economy, especially in the service sector?
Well, so the stimulus package that was enacted last year with the CARES Act targeted those people who were losing their jobs due to the effects of the recession. And that was a very good targeted program, but it was focused on the household income. The strategy in terms of small businesses was to a certain extent somewhat weak. Also, weak compared to other industrialized economies like Germany, who have been more proactive in helping small businesses. So one thing that we see in the data is that business centers across the country, like big cities, in which you have small businesses that have a lot of flow of income on a Monday to Friday schedule, suffer greatly because they are in high rent areas that are deserted right now. Because in these areas, people make high income, and they have been able, because of their skill levels, to work remotely and cope well with the recession, while these businesses are shut down. And if they have reopened, they don't have customers coming. So a strategy that targets more financial assistance towards this type of small businesses in areas of high flow that right now are not having high flow of consumers will be very welcome to help the economy cope with what is happening now. But with mitigating the crisis, with leaving this episode of a slowdown in the economy, we need to target the source, which is mitigating the transmission of the disease so that people feel safer to go and consume in these businesses again.
Well, again, you anticipated my next question, because if you go back to the third quarter, July through September, the gross domestic product in this country increased by over 33%. And a lot of people thought, okay, here we are. We're on the way back now. And I mean, that's an incredible percentage increase. But then in the fourth quarter, everything kind of went bust again. And it surprised some people, because the fourth quarter is usually when there's a lot of consumer spending due to the holidays. There wasn't as much consumer spending. But what happened? What happened between that third quarter and fourth quarter that, you know, saw that contributed to that 3.5% contraction?
So if we look at the health data, we hit a third wave of the pandemic. And the third wave of the pandemic has been quite detrimental. Like the curve, it looks as twice as large in number of cases and deaths as the first wave. And we thought the first wave was really bad. So I think that after the summer, with some of the reactivation that the reopening in different states had, and some of the reactivation at the industry level, and a little bit of the learning curve of we are learning how to live with the COVID pandemic, and we are learning how to manage the disease better in terms of medication and in terms of recovery of patients, there was a little bit of too much positivity, and people lowered their guard. And as people lowered their guard in terms of prevention of the disease, the number of cases spike in the last quarter. So it's not like what we see in terms of what appears to be a slowdown in the last quarter is simply that we didn't have a huge expansion as we were expecting, because people respond to their environment. If they see an environment in which the number of cases is high, they reduce their spending. And those people who have a higher income reduce their spending more than proportionally, affecting the economy even more. Now, I don't want to say with this that the last quarter wasn't good. Another aspect that is worth considering is that the third quarter shows a huge expansion compared to the previous one, showing that the economy is going kind of back on track at a fast pace, because we had a deep slowdown in the middle of the year. But the last quarter cannot like double the effects of what we or triple or skyrocket the huge gains of the third quarter. So it wasn't that good because the cases were increasing, but it also doesn't show in the data such a huge expansion, because July, September had an enormous expansion compared to the deep slowdown.
And there were actually a couple silver linings in the economy. One was in manufacturing activity, and the other was in housing. Why did we see an increase in manufacturing and housing during this period?
Well, that's interesting. I don't manage exactly the data on both sectors, but I have been looking at the data, and it really, from an economics perspective, both sectors showing an expansion give you a sign of more business confidence, because those two sectors are related to investment. So when we start seeing recovering economies, is when the investment in the economy starts expanding. And investment has increased during the second half of the year, driven, as you will say, by manufacturing expansions. So one aspect of the manufacturing expansion locally is more confidence domestically, but also there have been more demand for U.S. products overseas. So the exports of the United States in the manufacturing sector have expanded. Also, as the world economy is learning to live and is slowly recovering from the worst part of the pandemic. In terms of housing, that simply shows us that there is more confidence in markets. The fact that there are investors willing to have new housing startups, because they see that the demand is likely peaking for the housing, is a very good aspect. And then all of this comes accompanied with the fact that there are low interest rates. The mortgage market has had the interest rates really low, which is one of the tools of monetary policy that are used to foster economic activity. Keeping the interest rates low means that obtaining loans, including mortgage loans, is cheap, relatively cheap. So those people who have not seen their income as affected during the recession are seeing this as a good opportunity to buy a house. It's at a historic low. So investors in the housing industry are also taking advantage of this and having new housing startups.
poverty actually did increase. Oh, this wasn't related to the report that came out about the economy contracting, but this was a survey late last month at the University of Chicago and the University of Notre Dame showed that poverty increased by 2.4 percentage points to 11.8% in the second half of 2020. That's boosting the ranks of the poor by 8.1 million people. So, you know, even though there are some silver linings, there are more people who are falling under that federal poverty level. And so I guess this goes back to the big question, what has to happen? Is that $1.9 trillion stimulus or relief plan that the Biden administration is working on right now, is that part of the solution here, or are there other solutions?
So definitely a stimulus that targets people at the lower income distribution is part of the solution. But what the pandemic has done is show us that we have something bigger than just this disruption in 2020. The United States has a big unequal problem in which we have people at the bottom who are not getting the gains of the system. So when we are faced with crisis, they get affected in a more exacerbated way. See, for example, low-income households are more likely to work in the services in the services industry. So this is a services crisis, and it means that it has deeply affected them. Low-income households are more likely to have just one income earner. So if that income earner loses the job, they are more vulnerable. So they are more likely to have less educated parents. Consequently, not only we have short-term effects in terms of a shock of income for these households, throwing them into poverty, but if their kids are studying remotely, we are going to have long-term effects because kids studying remotely from parents who are struggling economically are going to be doing really bad. They don't have a support structure to keep with their studies in an academic year that is practically lost for many. And they are going to be more likely to drop out of elementary school, of high school, to not go to college. So we are going to have a more inequal society if we don't tackle the effects of this pandemic with a medium-term and long-term lens. So I think that we need to have immediate action to help these families falling into poverty with the stimulus bills, with support that goes beyond the pandemic and probably remains for 2 or 3 years afterwards following these families, and for longer-term measures that give us a better society in which there is more support for low-income families.
We only have about 2 minutes left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. The economy shed jobs for the first time, lost jobs for the first time in December, the first time in 8 months. Just heard that report today that in January we added 49,000 jobs. What does that number say to you, 49,000, that we added 49,000 jobs?
So, again, it's positive. Every time that we see these structures in the labor market giving us like a positive outlook in a scenario of uncertainty, it tells us that businesses are having confidence in the economy, that they're hiring, that they're attracting workers. But it doesn't tell us anything about inequality because we don't know what type of jobs are increasing. It could be, and I don't know the disaggregation of the job reports, that these jobs are more related to the type of jobs that can work remotely and can thrive more in the current situation, are more technology driven. So we still have a problem, which is to tackle the job creation of different skill levels in the country.
Well, I don't know. It sounds as if, what would you like to see? Okay, you've touched on some positivity in the economy, but there still are some negatives. In about 30 seconds or so, what would you like to see in the coming months that would show an improving economy?
Well, I would like to see not only the business and investment reactivating, but I would like to see targeted efforts of the government administration to help the businesses that needed the most and the households that needed the most. So we need to see an aggressive stimulus package that recognizes that we need to help those at the bottom, because otherwise we'll end up with an economy with big monopolies and big conglomerates and an economy that doesn't create opportunities for all. And this crisis is exacerbating those existing differences from decades.
Dr. Maria Ivanova-Reyes at Gettysburg College, thank you very much for being with us.